Chapter 4. The call from Raven came during Steele's briefing to the officers of Strike Force. When the desk sergeant found out what it was about, he called Captain Hardesty at once. Jake left the briefing room and took the call. When Steele came out of the briefing room, Hardesty was waiting for him.
"Go home," he said. "It's your son. He's there with Raven. She says something's really worked him over."
Officer Kevin Bishop was right behind Steele as they were coming out of the briefing room, and he immediately said, "Come on, we'll take my unit." They drove at top speed back to Steele's building. As they pulled up to the curb, Bishop said, "You want me to wait?"
"No, get back to your squad. I've got a chopper standing by up on the pad," said Steele. "And Kevin, thanks."
"Don't mention it." Steele hurried to the elevator and took it up to the penthouse floor. As he came in, Raven was coming out of the guest room with another man. He was carrying a medical bag.
"Lieutenant Steele," he said. "I'm Dr. Courtney. Security took the liberty of calling me. I'm on staff at the federal building."
"How bad is he?" said Steele.
"He'll be all right," said Dr. Courtney, reassuring him. "It looks much worse than it actually is. He was beaten up, but outside of a broken nose, some lacerations and contusions, he doesn't seem to have been seriously injured. Whatever hit him was apparently wearing some heavy rings, which accounts for the cuts. I was concerned about possible fractures and internal bleeding, but there seems to be no sign of that. I'd like to have him in for x-rays just to make sure, but the important thing right now is for him to get some rest. Aside from his injuries, he was quite distraught. I'd say he's been under a great deal of stress recently. I've just given him a sedative. He should remain in bed for a few days. Here's my card. Call me if there's any change, but I think he'll be all right. I'll have my office set up an appointment for him to come in a couple of days, but I don't think there's any need for hospitalization. At the very worst, I think we may be looking at some hairline fractures. But outside of his nose, nothing has been broken."
"Can I see him? Is he awake?"
"He should be getting a bit groggy by now, but yes, by all means, go see him. He's been asking for you."
"Thank you, doctor. I really appreciate you coming."
"No trouble at all. And don't worry about my bill. It's been taken care of by the agency."
"Thanks. Just the same."
Steele went in to see his son.
"Dad?"
Steele felt a lump in his throat. His stomach knotted up. Both because he hadn't seen his son in such a long time, and because he was now seeing him like this. In his time as a Strike Force cop, he had seen much worse. Far, far worse, but this was his own son. Jason lay in bed, on his back. His broken nose was taped. The blood had been cleaned off, and the doctor had said it wasn't serious. But Jason had been thoroughly worked over. One eye was puffed up almost completely shut. His mouth was cut. The rings on the hands of whoever had beat him up had seriously lacerated his face. He was a mass of bruises, all black and blue and swollen.
"Jason!"
He came over to the bed, kneeled, and took the boy in his arms. If he could have wept, he would have. But bionic eyes don't cry. Jason's arms tried to go around him, but he was already succumbing to the sedative. His voice was thick and slurred, partly from the drug and partly from the swelling and the damage to his lips.
"Mom said you were dead. She told us..."
"We can talk about that later," Steele said. "Who did this to you?"
"I'm sorry, Dad."
"Sorry? Sorry for what, for God's sakes? What's happened? Tell me."
"Feel tired, sleepy, beat me up."
"Who beat you up?"
"Pim."
"Tim? Tim who?"
"No, not Tim. Pim."
"Jason!"
"Let him sleep, Steele,"
said Raven from the doorway.
"He's been through a real bad time."
Jason's eyes flickered and then closed. In seconds, he was breathing deeply. Steele leaned forward and kissed his son on the forehead. He rose to his feet and left the room, shutting the door softly behind him.
"Did he tell you what happened?"
he said. Raven lit a cigarette. Her hand wasn't steady.
"Yes, he told me,"
she said flatly.
"Well?"
Raven inhaled the smoke deeply and then let it out in a long exhalation.
"You better sit down,"
she said. Seeing the expression on her face, Steele said nothing. He moistened his lips nervously and sat down on the couch.
"Go ahead,"
he said.
"He was beaten up by a pimp,"
she said.
"A pimp? Are you saying he's had some trouble with a hooker?"
"Not with a hooker,"
Raven said.
"Because of a hooker."
She took a deep breath and shook her head.
"There just isn't any easy way to say this. Your daughter's been turned out."
Steele stared at her. She held his gaze.
What are you saying?
Corey's pimp beat her up.
No, he shook his head. No, there must be some mistake. You didn't hear him, right, you?
We had a chance to talk before the doctor came,
she said. She came over and sat down beside him.
I don't know how it happened, but I think I can guess. I've seen it many times before. She came to town alone and frightened, thinking she burned all her bridges, too scared to go back home. You're not in the phone book. She didn't know where you were living now. Maybe that didn't even occur to her when she left. And she probably thought that if she went to the police, they'd pick her up and hold her while they called her mother. She was scared and lost. She hadn't really thought it through, and a kind stranger came up and started talking to her, asked her if she was all right and if she was in trouble, and maybe he could help buy her a cup of coffee, talk about it.
No, said Steele dumbly, shaking his head. No.
She had a friend, a girl named Marcia.
Steele looked at her.
Marcia Kastner, her best friend. Her family lived in the same building. The two of them went to school together.
Raven nodded.
Jason thought Corey might have gone to see her. He said they were very close. Well, Marcia had seen Corey. Corey called her. They met on 110th Street near the park. Corey was crying. She said she was in trouble. She asked her to call Jason to say she needed help. She told her...
Raven sighed and looked away.
Damn it, Steele, I'm sorry.
Steele felt as if he'd been punched in the stomach.
Oh, God!
He said.
She didn't know where you were,
said Raven.
And she was afraid to call the cops and ask for help. And probably she was ashamed.
Steele winced and shut his eyes.
She's only 15! She's just a little girl! Oh, Christ! Oh, Jesus Christ!
Raven put her arms around him. For a long moment, they simply sat there, holding each other. Then Steele pulled himself together and took a deep breath.
All right!
Swallowing hard.
Tell me the rest of it!
Marcia tried to call Jason up in Boston, but he'd already left to look for Corey. And Corey made her promise not to tell anybody else. Only Jason. Your ex-wife hit her with a lot of questions, and Marcia just hung up on her. She didn't know what to do. Then Jason showed up, and she told him the whole story. Corey had called her several times, and the next time she called, Marcia gave her Jason's number. He had some money in a savings account that he'd withdrawn when he left, and he was staying in some fleabag hotel. Corey wouldn't give him her number. She was afraid. They agreed to meet at the same place where Corey had met Marcia, by the park, only her pimp became suspicious and he followed her. Jason tried to tank him on, and the bastard beat him up, with Corey standing there and watching. And while Jason was lying there and bleeding, he told her if she ever tried to get in touch with him again, he'd kill him.
Who was he?
Said Steele, his voice hard.
What's the bastard's name?
Raven shook her head.
Jason didn't know. Corey never told him, but he said he could identify him.
This is Steele, he said. Let me talk to the old man right now.
A moment later, Jake came on the line.
Steele, I was just about to call you.
Jake, I want somebody down here with pictures of every single pimp that the department's got on file, and I want it done yesterday. Get!
Steele, listen to me. I don't know what this is all about, but it's gotta have to wait. Get on that chopper right away. Stalker's just been sighted down at Grandin Orchard. We've got units moving in.
Damn it, Steele said. Jake, stay on the line. I'm on my way.
He gave the phone to Raven.
Tell Hardesty what happened. Stalker's just been sighted. I've gotta move.
I'll take care of it,
she said. Feeling torn, Steele ran to the arms cabinet, grabbed his assault rifle, scooped up some magazines, and ran out to the helipad, where the small X-Wing was standing by. The pilot was having a smoke in the cockpit. The moment he saw Steele coming, he tossed a cigarette out and started up the engines. Steele leapt into the cockpit.
Lower East Side! Grandin Orchard! He shouted. Move it!
The X-Wing rose up into the air, banking steeply. Steele quickly checked his weapons. His son had been beaten to a pulp, and somewhere out there, his 15-year-old daughter was turning tricks for a sadistic pimp, and there was nothing he could do to help her. He wished he could have told Jake to go to hell, and Higgins too, and all the rest of them, but there was no way he could do that. The knowledge that Corey had been turned into a hooker twisted in his gut like a knife. He remembered what it had been like when he had first met Raven, whose crime boss boyfriend had dumped her on a pimp in no man's land. Hey there, just to break in here, this book's about to get really rough. just wanted you to be forewarned. She had been gang raped by a dozen men, members of a savage street gang called the Skulls. The thought of Corey be going through such an ordeal was more than he could bear. But until Jason came around again and could identify the pimp, there was nothing he could do. And Sakura was a deadly threat, a mad killer who could not be ignored. His son lay back in the apartment, his handsome young face, a symphony of cuts and bruises, his daughter forced into prostitution, and his best friend turned into a psychotic killing machine. Ever since he had awakened from his coma to discover that he had become a cyborg, part man and part machine, Steel had held on with desperation to the human part of himself, telling himself that he was not just a robot, that he had not just lost his soul, that he was more than just a computer encased in flesh and blood. The complex cybernetic matrix that was his mental engram programming left him with all his memories and all his feelings intact. But for once, for the first time since it happened, he found himself wishing that he was merely a machine, that he could turn off his emotions. But he couldn't, and they raged within him like a firestorm. He felt powerless, completely helpless, and consumed with hate. Hate for the whole world. Hate for the savage urban jungle that had done this to him and to his family. And he thought that he could begin to understand the rage that fueled the renegade cyborg that was once Mick Taylor, his former partner and best friend. A man whom he had worked with. A man who had been closer to him than his wife. A man whom he had loved. And whom he would now have to kill. If he could. Dev Cooper had been the picture of robust and virile health when he had first arrived at Project Steel headquarters from Los Alamos. A lanky Texan, fit and tanned from the southwestern sun. It hadn't been all that long ago. Project Steel had changed him. He had lost weight. He was pale. He slept poorly when he slept at all, and there were deep bags under his eyes. Often, he forgot to shave. His easygoing demeanor had been replaced by a frenetic nervousness. He had started smoking, and he lit one cigarette after another, always needing to have something in his hands, always fidgeting. His only previous vice had been drinking a bit too much, but now he drank incessantly. In the morning, some hair of the dog to steady his nerves. At work, he kept a bottle in his desk, and he poured booze into his coffee thermos. He drank throughout the day, and then he drank some more at night. He was one of those rare drunks who did not act drunk, unless one looked very closely and saw something that was just a bit off kilter with his eyes. Drinking slowed his reflexes, but he handled it well enough that it did not interfere with his work. At least, he told himself it didn't, and it never affected his speech. If anything, it slowed him down to a more normal mode, because his perpetual high-strung state gave him the metabolism of a high-performance dragster. But he knew that it would not continue. If he was not already an alcoholic, he was well on his way to becoming one. But he needed it. He needed the booze and pills, those time-honored crutches of psychiatrists who had shouldered too heavy an emotional burden and were heading straight for burnout. He recalled the hoary old joke among his colleagues, the story of a young psychiatrist fresh from his residency opening a private practice. At the end of his first week, the young doctor is a wreck, emotionally drained. He gets into the elevator after closing up his office, and, on the way down, the elevator stops at the lower floor, and another psychiatrist gets on, a respected older doctor, whose name is well known amongst his peers. He asks the younger doctor how he's doing, and the younger man breaks down, cataloging all the stress and pain he's been exposed to, asking the older doctor how he can possibly stand it, listening to it day in and day out. And the older doctor simply shrugs and says, "Who listens?" Well, there was one patient in particular that Cooper had to listen to, was compelled to listen to, and that patient frightened him more than any other patient had ever had in his entire career. He had specialized in abnormal psychology, often treating people who were truly too far gone and around the bend, split personalities and schizophrenics, some of them extremely dangerous. But this patient was the most dangerous of all. And though Dev Cooper did not feel any physical threat from this patient, he felt a threat to his immortal soul. The patient's name was Steel. Not Donovan Steel Cyborg, but Donovan Steel Program. A backup copy of the mental engram matrix that Steel had been programmed with. An electronic clone. A program that was alive and self-aware. A program that had just discovered what it was. For most of his adult life, Dev Cooper had not believed in a god. He had thought of himself as more an agnostic rather than an atheist, because it seemed to him that atheists made a religion of their non-belief. And as a scientist, Dev Cooper could not take refuge in that sort of certainty. Atheism, in itself, was just as much an act of faith as any other religion. Dev Cooper had not believed in God because he had not thought there was one, at least not as he was painted on the canvas of the Judeo-Christian tradition. If there was some guiding intelligence behind the creation of all things, Dev did not believe that it was anything that could be personified in human terms, something that cared about humanity in individual or even general terms, something that could be petitioned by the act of prayer. Now, he was not quite so sure. An old saying from an ancient war held that there were no atheists in foxholes. That no matter how strongly a man professed his disbelief, when the hammer came down and the bullets started flying, he broke down and started praying like a Carmelite? Sure. Dev had not yet been reduced to praying on his knees, perhaps because he simply could not bring himself to believe that it would help any more than the booze and pills did, but at least the booze and pills served to help deaden his emotions, like an anesthetic. He had, however, started talking to a priest, a Roman collar, a man named Father Liam Casey, Steele's close friend and confessor. He had first gone to Father Casey because of the priest's relationship with Steele. He had, of course, not expected Father Casey to reveal anything that Steele had said in the confessional, just as he could not reveal anything that Steele said to him during their sessions together. But the two men were close friends, and, in a way, both Father Casey and Dev Cooper were working both sides of the same street. Dev was Steele's therapist. Father Casey was his spiritual advisor. Steele was not a deeply religious man. He was a fallen Catholic, a man who had not attended church regularly since he had been a boy, a man who had made his own peace with himself and with his deity, lingering doubts and all. But some things died hard and never all the way. Before Steele had become a cyborg, when he found himself feeling lost and confused, awash in self-doubt and guilt over his disintegrating marriage, he had wandered into St. Vincent's one day and made his way to the confessional, where Father Casey sat behind the screen. He started to confess, haltingly, but it hadn't quite worked out, at least not in the traditional way. He felt awkward in the darkened booth, uncomfortable with the ritual, ill at ease with not being able to see the face of the man he was unburdening his soul to. So Father Casey, who is in many ways a rather different sort of priest, has suggested that they continue their discussion over a few beers in the bar across the street, and that had marked the beginning of their friendship. Dev Cooper had gone to see him in the hope of furthering his understanding of his patient, who, despite their fairly good relationship, had a deeply ingrained mistrust of psychiatrists and had never really opened up to Dev. Instead, Dev wound up opening up to Liam Casey. "I'm not a Catholic," had been one of the first things that he told the priest. The priest had smiled and said, "Hell, nobody's perfect." Father Liam Casey was of medium height and stocky, with an athletic build, short blonde hair and beard, and incredibly alert, light green eyes that were flecked with gold. He was in his early 50s, though he looked younger, and with the exception of his collar, he made no concessions to priestly fashion, preferring to dress casually in tweed sport coats, jeans, and western boots. Though he had no official clearance with the Steele Project, nor was he involved with it in any way beyond his professional relationship with Steele, the agency had checked him out most carefully, and Higgins had determined that Father Casey possessed no security risk. Nevertheless, Dev was well aware that he had told the priest far more than he should have. He had not told him all at once. Strictly speaking, the confidentiality of the confessional could not apply to Dev since he was not a Catholic and thus could not go to confession, but as Dev got to know him better over the time they spent together, he became convinced that Father Casey could be trusted. Just the same, lately, his paranoia was increasing. He imagined agents following him everywhere, with bolometric mics, and God only knew what other devilish devices, listening to his every word. He had taken to meeting Father Casey in very public places where there was a lot of covering noise, usually at a bar. For his part, Liam Casey was concerned about Dev Cooper. They had known each other for only a short time, but both of them were the sort of men who were able to judge character, and they had soon developed a strong mutual trust and liking for each other. Father Casey saw Dev Cooper unraveling before his very eyes. Cooper's nerves were shot. It was not immediately visible, because Dev Cooper kept himself well in hand, but Liam Casey noticed how much he'd been drinking, noticed the telltale signs of growing pill dependency, noticed the frantic desperation lurking deep in Cooper's eyes. The worst part of it was they had no answers for him. When Steele had first come to him after his transformation, Steele had been concerned about his own humanity and seeking reassurance. Father Liam Casey had told him there were no easy answers, but he had been able to keep Steele to help Steele find answers of his own. Answers that, for Steele, for the time being at any rate, seemed to suffice despite the lingering doubts. With Dev, it was much harder. Dev Cooper presented him with a problem that seemed insurmountable, and Liam Casey understood why it had driven him to such a state. Increasingly, they discussed theology. Dev Cooper, the scientist and secular philosopher, could not believe in God, yet it seemed suddenly important to him that he try. He played devil's advocate, dismantling his own attempts at faith, struggling to have it proved to him somehow beyond all doubt and argument that God existed, that there was something higher, a rational order to the universe. He could not make the leap of faith. He seemed determined to hang on to the ladder of his pragmatism, but Dev, a deeply ethical and moral man, needed to believe in something, and his secular worldview no longer seemed enough. It was not Liam Casey's mission to convert him, though many of his fellow priests might have disagreed with that. Liam Casey did not become a priest in order to become a missionary, in order to sell God. He became a priest because he found his greatest satisfaction in trying to do good. Helping people was his calling, the way he served his God. Most often, he helped them in his role as a Catholic priest, but there were times when he merely helped them as a man, without imposing judgments or conditions. He was well-read and educated with a lay knowledge of psychiatry, philosophy, and ethics, and he could discourse with erudition on a wide variety of subjects, none of which could help him to help Dev. Dev's problem was unique, and it had become Liam Casey's problem too, a problem that he could not share with anybody else because, though Dev was not a Catholic, Dev had come to him in trust, and he owed it to him to give him the same confidentiality that he would give to his parishioners who came to him for confession. Together, they struggled to resolve a problem for which no solution seemed available. Could a living, self-aware computer program have a human soul? The young woman dancing on the stage not far from their table in the darkened corner was wearing nothing save a G-string and extremely thin high heels. From time to time, one of the customers seated at chairs placed around the perimeter of the stage would place a dollar bill on the apron, and she would saunter over to him, crouch down very close so that his eyes were on a level with her barely covered genitalia. She would then pick up the money, roll it up to make a tube, and place it between the patron's teeth. Then, holding the G-string away from her, she would allow the patron to bend forward and, like a parrot with a seed, deposit the tip inside. Then she'd give him a quick kiss, bend backward, and proceed to thrust her crotch into his face, gyrating her pelvis as the man stared spellbound at the gate of hell. The gate of what? Oh my god. It was an odd place to meet a priest. But Dev never picked the same place twice, and this one had the virtue, albeit dubious, of having a sound system that was extremely loud and almost constant in its deafening assault. They could speak, but anyone attempting to eavesdrop on their conversation would never be able to make out what they said over the music. The girl finished her obligatory three numbers, and as another girl climbed up on the stage to take her place, she came down and walked straight over to their table, her attention apparently caught by the only two men in the bar who were not paying attention to her. "Hey, how come you two are being so shy back there? Would you like a table dance?" And then she noticed Liam's collar and her eyes went wide. "No, thank you, dear," said Liam, slipping her a tip. "I'm just helping my friend here with a little family counseling, if you know what I mean. You can be a love and bring us two more drinks." "Oh yeah, sure," she said. She glanced at Dev. "Listen, honey, if you're having a little trouble getting it turned on, stop by and see me later. I get off at 10. I do a little family counseling, too." She turned and swiveled off towards the bar on her high heels. "Friendly girl," said Liam. "Look, maybe this wasn't such a good idea," Dev said. "We could find another place." No, that's all right. This place is fine," said Liam. "They water down their drinks a bit, but if they do it one more time, I'll send them back and threaten to excommunicate the bartender. Although watering yours down might not be such a bad idea. You've been hitting the sauce pretty hard lately." "I know," said Dev. "I can always hold it pretty well, but it's starting to catch up with me." "It's starting to caught up with you and past you," Liam said. "You look worse every time I see you." "Yeah," said Dev. "It's getting so as I can hardly stand looking in the mirror anymore, for more reasons than one." "I'm not your priest, Dev, and I certainly don't want to start sounding like your mother. But I am your friend, and as your friend, I'm telling you that you're in trouble. You're too good a psychiatrist to take refuge in denial. You need to get yourself under control. You need help.
I know, Liam. But there isn't anywhere where I can go for help.
Nonsense. You go check into a hospital, or I could refer you to a support group. To counseling.
You think that I don't know about all that? Said Dev. Those aren't options I could consider. I'm part of a top secret government project, Liam. And I've already compromised security by involving you.
I was already involved before I even met you, Casey said. Because of Steel. Believe me, your Mr. Higgins left no stone unturned when he checked into my past. I've been interrogated. My friends have been questioned. My neighbors, my bishop, people whom I knew in childhood and attended seminary with. I'm certain they broke into my apartment and searched it thoroughly, though I can't prove it. And I'd be surprised if they didn't have my phone tapped. I couldn't be any more involved. And so far, the CIA is apparently satisfied that I do not pose a security risk. I'm far from what they would consider a team player, but I obviously don't worry them. Anyone can get in trouble out of all this. If anyone can get in trouble out of all this, it isn't me. It's you. You could lose your job.
I sometimes wish that I would, said Dev. I sometimes wish that I'd never taken it. But they won't cut me loose. I suppose I know too much. They need me. If they get really worried, I suppose there's a chance that they might kill me, but I doubt if it will come to that. Higgins knows I'd never jeopardize the project. It means too much to me. I'm like a junkie, Liam. I'm hooked. I'm afraid.
How can I help you, Dev? What can I do?
I don't know, said Cooper. I guess it helps a lot just to have someone to talk to. Someone who's not connected with the project.
The dancer came back and brought their drinks. Dev paid for them. Don't drink anymore, Dev. Please. Dev shook his head.
That's not the problem, Liam. The problem is that I can't drink enough. I don't know what to do about the program. Now, Higgins has a copy, too. He knew I had it all along. He knew Gates gave it to me. He even has my apartment bugged. I looked everywhere, but I can't find them. He had someone come into my apartment and use my modem to send a backup download to my project headquarters so he could see what I've been doing with the program. He thinks that I've been fiddling with it, changing it. I told him that I hadn't, but I don't think he believed me. I tried to explain it to him, and he acted as if he understood, but I don't really think he does. It's inconceivable that anyone could understand and not be terrified by the implications of it.
What are the implications? Liam asked.
It goes beyond the moral question of whether or not we have a right to play at being Dr. Frankenstein, said Dev. Nobody ever really thought this through. I have. I've been able to think of nothing else. They're all fascinated by the technology, like kids with a new toy. We can stick a whole little biochip into someone's brain and allow them to interface with a computer. And then we find out that we can use the biochip to download the information in a person's brain and store it in a computer as a mental engram matrix that can then be programmed into a cybernetic brain. But now we know that we can use the same technology to download mental engrams and duplicate them. Back them up the same way that you do with software to make an unlimited number of copies. It terrifies me to think of what they might do with that technology. It would be more like Xeroxing human beings, continued Dev, growing more animated. Only they'd be electronic clones, self-aware, and sentient personalities without bodies. In a sense, they'd be almost like people like us, only they'd be alive in some computer, existed only when they were booted up and then placed back into some sort of limbo, suspended animation, a sort of electronic coma where they were in storage. They wouldn't be capable of feeling anything. Or perhaps they would. Who knows? Certainly not in the physical sense, but they would still have their emotions, their thoughts, the personalities of the original human being that they were duplicated from. How would you feel if you suddenly woke up one day to discover that you had no body, that you couldn't see or smell or touch, and you couldn't hear unless you were hooked up to an audio peripheral, and that you couldn't speak unless a VS peripheral was attached, and that you couldn't. And they've been reduced to a line of more than an electronic slave to be turned on and off at will as the user. Liam, we'd be creating an entire subspecies of human beings, an electronic subspecies, people that have been reduced to a software. It's more mind-boggling than any of the human exponential horrors carried on by the likes of Joseph Mengele in World War II. More terrifying than that scare that swept across society when recombinant DNA first became possible. People were afraid that we wind up creating monsters. It says exactly what we're doing now. It's what I've done. I've created a human, electronic Frankenstein's monster. And the only way to uncreate it is to erase the program. And I could do that, but it wouldn't be, would it be murder, Liam? Wouldn't it be like killing Steel?
Does Steel know about the backup program? Liam asked, a somber impression on his face.
No, of course not, Dev said. How could I possibly tell him? What would I say? There's another version of yourself backed up on my computer, and there's still another one in Higgins' office. We already had one cyborg go insane, and Steel is having problems with the electronic ghost within his matrix. Something like this could put him right over the edge.
What are you going to do? Asked Liam.
I don't know, said Dev, shaking his head. I just don't know. Would it be murder to erase the program?
Liam took another deep breath and let it out slowly. I don't know, Dev. I can't tell you. Under ordinary circumstances, no, of course it wouldn't be murder to erase a program, but these are human mental engrams. If you're asking me in my capacity as a priest, all I can tell you is that I don't think the church would take the position that information downloaded from a human brain can be considered human, that it would have a soul. If you were a Catholic, and if the church found out about this, they might have you excommunicated. But if you're asking me as a man, well, then all I can tell you is that when I talk to Steele, I don't feel as if I'm talking to a machine. I feel as if I'm talking to the same man I knew before he was given a cybernetic brain transplant. That's only how I feel. It's a question that theologians and philosophers, greater minds than ours, would probably argue about for years. Sometimes our feelings are all we have to go on.
Even if it would be murder, Dev said, staring down into his glass, perhaps it would be the kindest thing to do.
Liam shook his head. I can't agree with that, he said. I may not be your priest and you may not be Catholic, but I'm still concerned about your soul. I'll pray for you. He grimaced and then sighed. You know, I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but for the first time in my life, those sound like empty words. Are you sure you're not the devil, Dev? You're starting to make me think like a secular humanist. Dev smiled weakly.
Maybe I am the devil, he said. Doesn't the church say that God is within every one of us? Maybe the devil is as well.
He waved for another drink. The girl started to come over, but Liam shook his head and waved her back. She shrugged and went back to attend to another customer. Don't, Dev, Liam said. You've had enough.
No, said Dev. Not halfway near enough.
I can't let you have another drink, Dev. I shouldn't have let you have the last one. It isn't going to help.
I'll go get it myself, then,
Dev said, lurching to his feet. Liam got up and took him by the arm. Dev, please, it's not the answer.
Answer? Dev said. I don't even know the question anymore. Come on. Let go of my arm, Liam.
No, I'm not going to do that. You've had enough, Dev. Come on. Let's go. Look, you can barely stand. Come back to my place and sleep it off. We'll talk more in the morning. Or let me take you home.
No, said Dev. It's waiting for me there. The program. That electronic clone. That Frankenstein's monster I created. Waiting with its questions and accusations. No, I'm not going home. I'm staying right here. I'm going to get good and drunk, and then I'm going to talk to a nice girl about some of that counseling she offered.
Liam pulled on Dev's arm. No, you're not. Come on. We're getting out of here.
Let go of me, said Dev, shoving him away.
Dev.
Go home, Liam. Leave me alone.
I'm sorry. I can't do that.
Well, fuck you then.
Dev turned away and started walking toward the bar. Liam caught up with him. Dev, please.
Back off, goddammit.
Dev shouted, shaking his hand off. Liam sighed. I'm sorry, Dev, he said, and smashed a right hand across Dev's jaw. He caught him as Dev started to crumple to the floor.
Hey!
Shouted the bartender. It's all right, said Liam. My friend here has just had a bit too much to drink.
Look, I don't want any goddamn trouble.
Oh, I'm sorry, Father. I didn't see the collar. It's all right, my son, said Liam. I'll just take him home to sleep it off.
Let me call you a cab, and I'll give you a hand with him when he gets there.
Thank you. I appreciate that. He lowered Dev into a booth and sat down beside him.
Nice punch you got there, Father. Can I get you anything?
Said the girl. No, thank you. I'll just wait for the cab.
Sure you wouldn't like a table dance while you're waiting?
Get thee behind me, Liam said.
Huh?
He smiled. Never mind, a small religious joke. Here, this is for your trouble.
Thanks, hon. Come back and see me, okay?
Father Casey smiled in spite of himself. Some people had no shame. He glanced at the unconscious man in the booth beside him, and his smile faded. Dev Cooper, to his credit, wasn't one of them. End of chapter.